I am on page 11 right now, and the title is Osmosis. On page 11 at the very top, water movement by osmosis. What is osmosis? Osmosis is the diffusion of water across a semipermeable membrane. What you need a semipermeable membrane, and you need a solute concentration difference. And the water will move from an area of low solute concentration to an area of high solute concentration. And if, for example, salt is our solute, then the water will diffuse to the side of the membrane where the salt concentration is higher. This causes then, if this is inside of a cell, then this causes the cell to swell and possibly even to burst. So that is the next one is estimating osmolarity. That is one of the required experiments by the IB. That is the potato osmosis experiment. And what we've been doing here is we've been submerging potato cubes in different concentrations of salt and salt or sugar, depending on what you want to use. And we've seen the following, that if the salt concentration is very low, then the potato will increase its mass. So you have to calculate the mass, change the absolute numbers of the mass into percentages. And if the salt concentration is high and or is above a certain level, then the potato will lose water and the mass will decrease. And the point here is that we're measuring the concentration in moles per liter, and we have to calculate a percent because the different potato cubes, of course, have a different original mass, and therefore you cannot compare it otherwise. There are two different ways how you can calculate this. The mass change of zero means that there is no change, or you can also say the percentage of the original. In this case, 100% would be a 0% mass change. So 100% would then be the original weight. And the place where the line on page 11 on the right crosses the x-axis, this at this concentration, the potato is said to be isotonic to its surrounding solution. Isotonic means that it has the same concentration. Accuracy in osmosis experiments, some practical indicators here that you have to use a very accurate and very precise balance. But concerning theory, the bottom one over here, avoiding osmosis in donor organs, bottom right. That is important when you have donor organs or organ transplantations. They must be transported, but they are then placed in so-called isotonic saline. Saline is salt water. And isotonic means that the concentration is the same inside the organ as on the outside, and this prevents the organ from dehydrating and also from taking up too much water and cells bursting. So isotonic saline prevents basically keeps the water concentration the same inside the organ. Next page, page 12, title of the page, active transport. Active transport across the membrane. Active transport requires energy. It's called, and we are now using pump proteins. And if you flip back, you already know about these because on page 9 on the bottom, we also have already active transport pumps as an example. And what happens here is the following, that the drawing here at the top, you see this little circle, the dark gray ball over there, that's supposed to be the substance that's transported. On the very, on the left, you see that the circle, there is an arrow pointing towards the right. I have no idea why it's pointing towards the right. This doesn't make sense. The circle, the little substance that goes into the channel protein, so it actually should be pointing downwards. And we're at number 2. And then you can see that the protein, channel protein, flips over, and this requires ATP. And in active transport, we're pumping the substances from an area of lower concentration to an area of higher concentration. Because remember, in diffusion, facilitated diffusion, it's exactly the other way around. The substances move passively from an area of higher concentration to lower concentration. But here we're going the opposite direction here. Okay, so middle one, structure and function of the sodium potassium pumps in axon. Do not confuse this now with the potassium channel proteins that I talked about on page 10. This one is an active transport, and this is the thing that I already mentioned briefly when we're trying to restore the so-called resting potential. Later on in when we do the neurobiology, that's explained. But the thing here that you need to know, number one, you need ATP, it is a pump, and number two, it's an anti-porter system. What does this mean? That means that when we pump potassium into one side, we're pumping at the same time sodium to the other side. So it's a pump which works into both directions, but we're pumping different substances into both directions. And that's basically the summary of this diagram over here. So for every two potassiums, K+, that is pumped to the inside, We're pumping 3 sodiums out. So, page 12 on the bottom, transport using vesicles. Well, so far I only talked about the membrane transport using simple diffusion, facilitated diffusion, and active transport across the membrane itself. But membranes are very flexible and can also be used and are also used to generally transport substances out of the cell by a process called exocytosis. So for example, when organs, glands produce digestive enzymes or whatever, and this has to be released, yeah, then a different system will be used. Endocytosis is the uptake of substances into the cell, and exocytosis is also known as secretion, where substances are given off. Membranes play a very important role. Very quickly over here, on the rough endoplasmic reticulum, proteins are made on the ribosome because ribosomes make proteins. And from the RER, vesicles start to form. And these vesicles then go to the Golgi apparatus where they fuse with the membrane of the Golgi, like soap bubbles are able to fuse. And in the Golgi, the protein is chemically modified and concentrated. Then on the other side of the Golgi, new vesicles are formed, which are then carried to the plasma membrane. And in the plasma membrane, and these vesicles then fuse with the plasma membrane, releasing the contents out into the lumen. In endocytosis, which is can be seen on the right, on the left side, is where the membrane folds inwards and forming then a little a vesicle containing now the substances that was taken up. Please know the sequence of steps here. For your information, very important, sometimes they give you a picture, an electron micrograph with a cell which contains a lot of RER. And if there is a lot of RER present, then this means that the substance is producing a lot of proteins to be secreted. So it could be a gland or cell that you're looking at. Much RER means a lot of proteins being made, means a lot of exocytosis. Page 13, the origin of cells. So first of all, cell division and cell origins. In the 19th century, the scientists weren't quite sure where do cells come from, and they proposed one possibility that maybe there's something called spontaneous generation, which is the concept that living things can appear out of non-living material. And this is a contradiction of the cell theory and is of course not correct. Louis Pasteur, he made an experiment to disprove that. And what he did is the following. He was able to show that if you keep a nutrient broth, some kind of food for the bacteria, and if you prevent bacteria from reaching this nutrient soup, then the bacteria are also not going to automatically form. You have to have exposure to bacteria, and then they will fall into the soup, they will start dividing, reproducing, it's going to spoil it. We see the same principle nowadays, even for example when we have tin cans which contain food which can store without refrigeration. And the reason is because there are no bacteria in the tin can. And once you open it, then you've got to eat it very quickly. But inside the tin can, if it's properly made, there are no bacteria, and that means no bacteria will actually also form. So however, origins of the first cells, next box. The first cells, of course, must have appeared from non-living material. So that is, of course, maybe one of the things. However, we know with a very, very, very high degree of certainty that all living things are related because of certain genetic and similarities, and the genetic code in all living things is the same, even though it doesn't have to be like this. But it is. So that means this cannot be coincidence. This means that all living things must be related. So that is the very important evidence that all living things actually have one origin, because all 64 codons of the genetic code have the same meaning in all of the cells. So, bottom box, the endosymbiotic theory. And it is like this. What is symbiosis? Symbiosis is when two organisms cooperate and both benefit. So it is not a predation, it's not a predator-prey relationship, it's not a parasitic relationship, both benefit, that's called symbiosis. And the endosymbiotic theory tries to explain how eukaryotic cells, those with a nucleus and with mitochondria and chloroplasts, how they came into being. And in the picture over here, we see that at the beginning there was a cell without a mitochondrion, and then an aerobic bacterium, that's one that is able to use oxygen to burn food, moved into the host cell and started to live in there until the two cells became so dependent on each other that there is no possibility for leaving anymore. And this happened a second time with a photosynthetic bacterium, and this then also moved in, and then we had a plant cell. And there is very strong evidence for that. First of all, both chloroplasts, so the photosynthetic bacteria became a chloroplast. Chloroplasts and mitochondria have their own DNA. They have 70S ribosomes, just like bacteria, and they also have several membranes. The one membrane is the one that they originally came along with, and the other membrane is the membrane surrounded which it got from its host cell. So there is very strong evidence, and scientists also did DNA analysis, of course, of the mitochondrial and chloroplast DNA, and were indeed able to determine that mitochondria are highly related to the so-called proteobacteria, and that the chloroplasts are highly related to the so-called cyanobacteria. Additional information here. Okay, so also they have their own DNA. Their DNA in mitochondria and in chloroplast is a naked loop of DNA that looks like a bacterial DNA. They have double membranes. I already mentioned that. 70S ribosomes. Okay, and mitochondria and chloroplasts inside the cell, they also divide just like prokaryotes. Page 14, mitosis. So we're now back at the eukaryotes here. Mitosis is cell division in eukaryotes. Remember, prokaryotes do binary fission, much simpler. Chromosomes and condensation, page 14, top box, top left. It is like this, that the DNA of eukaryotes, there are several DNA strings, and they have to be copied, of course, and moved around in a cell for cell division to make sure that every cell has the same DNA. This is very difficult. It's very difficult to move the DNA around if it is in loose form. Therefore, we have the cell condenses the DNA to make chromosomes. Chromosomes are much tighter and more compact and can be more easily moved around. That is the whole purpose. The formation of chromosomes is called condensation, becomes more dense, and the DNA supercoils. And the supercoiling means that it wraps around itself. Okay, it's first of all, it's anyway wrapped around histone proteins, but it's wrapped again in loops, and these loops are looped into further higher, larger loops, and so on. And this is called supercoiling. And we have to do that before we separate the DNA. The DNA has to be copied, then we have the DNA has to be supercoiled and condensed to form chromosomes, and then we can separate the identical chromosomes. So, number page 14, top right, there's always a question is now, what is a chromosome, what's a chromatid? And the thing is the following, it's a little bit an overlapping definition. The identical copies of the DNA are called sister chromatids, and they're identical because of cell DNA replication. They were copied because both cells should have the same DNA. Those two sister chromatids are held together at the centromere. And the question is now, how do we define a chromosome? And the IB uses the following definition. Different scientists use a different one, but the IB simply wants to simplify it. And it's like this, that the sister chromatid, the chromosomes, when they are attached to each other on the centromere, we refer to it as sister chromatids. And then when they separate, then we refer to them as chromosomes. So that's a little bit an interesting thing to say because that's the definition that the IB uses. Different scientists use a different one. As long as they're connected, we say they're two sister chromatids, and then the centromere splits, they're separated in mitosis, and then we have two chromosomes. Next one, page 14, the middle part, the phases of mitosis. So number one, it starts off in early prophase, and over here the following happens. The DNA condenses, it becomes they become chromosomes. The nuclear membrane disappears, the nucleus disappears, and spindle fibers, spindle microtubules are forming. In late prophase, this process is completed, and the chromosomes, I shouldn't say chromosomes, the sister chromatids have attached now to the spindle fiber. And in metaphase, it is like this, that the sister chromatids are pulled to the equator of the cell. It's important to do that because this establishes a symmetry. Please notice that by this point now we do not have a nucleus anymore, and the cell has not yet divided. Okay, right now we're only concerned about separating the DNA within the cell. The next stage over here, it says anaphase. In anaphase, the two sister chromatids, they separate because the centromere splits, and now they become, according using IB definitions, they become chromosomes. And they are pulled to the poles of the cell by the spindle microtubules. Then in telophase, we have the telophase essentially is the reversal of prophase. The DNA decondenses, it becomes loose chromatin again. The nuclear membrane reappears. And then at the very end of telophase, the cell divides, and this cell division is called cytokinesis. So that is then when we have two cells, and this can only happen, the cytokinesis, after we have separated the DNA. Next box, bottom right, cytokinesis. Cytokinesis is different in plants and animal cells. Plant cells have a cell wall, therefore they have to build a new cell wall between the DNA, okay, between the two nuclei. So we're building a new cell wall, a new cell membrane. And cytokinesis in animals is like this. The cell kind of pinches off, the membrane folds inwards. That's possible because it's flexible, because there's no cell wall. The membrane folds inwards, forming two cells. Bottom left, mitotic index. You have to know this formula. Essentially, the mitotic index is the proportion of cells that are in mitosis, the percentage of cells that divide, okay? But they do not multiply by 100, okay? So the mitotic index is the number of cells in mitosis over the total number of cells. And this means that this is very important for also determining whether a certain tissue is cancerous, because if there are too many dividing cells in there, then you know that this might be a cancerous tissue. For those of you who are in higher level, in the apical meristems of plants, for example, of course the mitotic index is higher because you've got many dividing cells there, because this is the part of the plant that grows. So we are now moving on to page 15, cell cycles and cancer. At the very top, the cell cycle in eukaryotes. Over here you see a drawing. I think in my view, the mitosis section, which is the lower part over here, is I think too large. Mitosis does not generally use half of the cell cycle, but it's actually much less. It's relatively short. And the cell cycle now includes interphase and mitosis. Interphase is the non-dividing part of the life of a cell. And when we draw a cell with a nucleus and the organelles and everything, that is then an interphase cell. There's something that happens very important in interphase, and that is the DNA is copied in so-called S phase. In S phase, that is the synthesis phase, and this is the place when the time when the DNA is copied, and only after the DNA has been copied, the cell is able to progress into the G2 phase, which is a checkpoint phase where we the cell determines whether everything is ready for cell division, and then we're the cell starts rolling and goes into prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase, cytokinesis, and then we've got two cells, and these two cells go into G1, and G1 is gap 1, and this basically means that is the time when the cell is making proteins and the cell is living normally, whatever normal means in this context. Okay, and then the cell cycle continues. Now, that is number one. Number two, on page 15, cyclins and cell cycle control. There was a scientist who got the Nobel Prize, Tim Hunt. He accidentally discovered cyclins, and this is an accidental discovery in the sciences called serendipity. And he accidentally discovered that there are certain chemicals in cells that change their concentration depending on the cell cycle. And these are, he called them cyclins A, B, E, D, whatever. And you can see in the diagram on page 15 that the concentrations change over the cell cycle. So what is the take-home message here? The take-home message is that the cell cycle is controlled using chemicals. What happens if the cell cycle goes out of control? Then we have a tumor, and that is the next box, page 15 on the right, tumor formation. Oncogenesis, that is the formation of tumors, and oncogenes are DNA genes which have which somehow influence the cell cycle, and if there's a problem with the oncogenes, then we have possibly a tumor. Important for you to understand is if there are DNA changes or mutations, then this can be or often is a triggering tumor formation, especially if there are mutations in these oncogenes. So any substance that is DNA damaging is carcinogenic, cancer causing. There are two types of tumors, primary and secondary tumors. Usually it's like this, that if a tumor starts in one place, this is called a primary tumor. This can be operated away, hopefully very quickly. If you wait too long, then cells are going to break off. These are called metastases, and they spread over the body and are able to form so-called secondary tumors, because these cells then will form multiple tumors in other parts of the body, and this is something that you definitely want to avoid, because then the whole thing goes really out of control. But as long as you have a primary tumor, there's still a possibility to treat this somehow relatively more or less easily, I guess. You know, you can either operate it away or use radiation treatment or whatever, therefore you can get rid of the primary tumor. But if one secondary tumors have formed, you have tumors all over your body forming, and that's of course much more difficult to treat. And the breaking off of the cells and to form secondary tumors, either called metastases. If you're concerned about cancer, then the best thing to do is that you do not smoke, because there is a very clear and a very documented link between smoking and cancer. The thing is the following. Could it be correlation? Could it be, is it causation? I mean, maybe people who smoke have a generally higher level of cancer because of their general lifestyle habits, you know, and maybe smoking does not cause cancer, but this is not correct. There is a the so-called P53 protein, and this means that the chance of a person obtaining cancer because of smoking is now much more clearly established. Of course, this does not mean that if you don't smoke, you don't get cancer, and it does also not mean that if you smoke, you will definitely get cancer, but the chance is greatly increased, and there seems to be now a causal link also established over the so-called the P53 protein in the cells, which are directly influenced, which is directly influenced by cancer, by cigarette smoke. So this was topic one. Okay, very quick run through topic one. I wish you all the best.